pleased to bring you our feature presentation.
Hi, this is Peter Mortel, and I'm a big-ass runner from Green Bay, Wisconsin, the land of cheese and crackers and beer and Packers. Welcome to the Big Ass Runner Podcast, where we entertain and encourage trail runners from all over the world. Now, here's your host, Jeff Harrell.
Well, thank you, Peter Mortel. That was the intro from episode number 2. That is in the Wayback Machine. Right there. Well, as Peter said, my name is Jeff Harrell. This is the Big Ass Runner Trail Running Podcast, episode number 154. We have a very special episode today. Every episode I feel is special. This is unique, special, if that makes any sense at all. We have the honor and privilege of chatting with Michael McKnight. If you don't know Mike, he just won the Cocodona 250. He has won the Triple Crown of 200s. And he is just an awesome person. Absolutely awesome person. We get to chat about a lot of different things. His background, his growing up, overcoming some issues medically, bullying, some things like that. His Cocodona 250 experience. It was an amazing story, and a little bit about him and his faith. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. Without further ado, let's jump right into it. This is my conversation with Michael McKnight. Well, now joining us on the Big Ass Runner Hotline is Michael McKnight. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to chat.
Man, I'm so excited to have you on, and I have so many questions. But before we get to all my list of questions, I want to share a little bit about our listener, though. This is the Big Ass Runner herd that you're talking to. It's what we call our listeners, is the herd. And they are everyday runners. They're balancing life and training and doing hard things. And some of them probably know you a little bit, but I would love for all of them to get to know you. So tell us a little bit about you, where you are in the world, a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I live in northern Utah, a small community called Cache Valley. It's composed of outdoor enthusiasts and farmers, basically. I'm about an hour and a half north of Salt Lake. The Idaho border is approximately 20 minutes from my house. But yeah, I've essentially lived here my whole life. I served a mission for my church, which was in Toronto, Canada for a time. And then I moved to Denver with my family for a job opportunity, but got there and quickly realized that that opportunity was not right for me. And so I quit and we came right back to here just because we love this area so much. It's for whoever's been to Boulder or Golden, Colorado, it's a very similar vibes, but just less busy and more affordable. So it's perfect. I grew up on a dairy farm. I have a wife and 2 kids. My oldest boy is 6. My daughter's 3. And, you know, you say that this podcast is for like the everyday runner that's trying to balance life, work, and running and all that stuff. I've been there. The majority of my running career was like that. And it was only recently that I've been more of a coach and an athlete. And so I totally get the struggles of trying to balance all that.
And I think, and spoiler alert, by the way, if you didn't know, Mike won the Cocodona 250. We're going to talk about that here in a little bit. But I think a lot of times as everyday runners, we think of elite athletes as people who have been doing this their whole life. They train from the age of 2, you know, to become these elite athletes. I'm curious about your background growing up, you know, in your childhood. Were you an athlete? Did you do sports? And then how did you get into running?
No, I was not an athlete. Yeah, like I said, I grew up on a dairy farm. I actually grew up fairly overweight. I ate a lot. And, you know, like a lot of people, like when I tell people I grew up on a dairy farm, they're just like, well, how'd you gain weight? You're out on the fields, like moving pipe, lifting hay bales. It's like, it's a lot more sitting in a tractor than people realize. And so lots of sitting in a tractor, you know, a lot of the pipe that we move is automatic. You know, there's only a few fields that we had where we'd like actually have to pick up a hand line and carry pipe. For the most part, it was just turn on a motor and watch it go. So it's not as physically intense as a lot of people think it was. There definitely was like sleep deprivation for having to get up early and take care of the cows. But yeah, so no physical activity growing up. I gained weight. And it was about the summer between my ninth grade and 10th grade year. So I was in junior high, getting ready to go to high school. And I was terrified of like the seniors picking on me for how overweight I was. And so that was when I decided to start running to lose weight. And so I ran a mile a day, cleaned up my diet. And I essentially, what I did was I ate the serving size, which is very difficult. I don't know if you ever tried to measure half a cup of milk to pour on your cup of cereal in the morning. But yeah, it's not easy to just eat the serving sizes. So I lost a lot of weight and stopped running because like in my head, like running was all that you did to lose weight. Like it was kind of like a punishment almost in my mind. But a couple of years later, I did try doing track and football more so for the social aspect. I didn't put in a lot of training. I didn't put in a lot of hard work. And I mean, the results showed because I was in last place at all of my track meets. And then I rode the bench in football. So that was the extent of my athletic career, you could say, in high school, was just 2 years of trying football and track, but not really pushing myself that much.
And I think that's probably refreshing for a lot of us to hear, because I was in a similar situation, although it wasn't weight loss. I just wasn't, you know, the best athlete growing up. And I know a lot of our listeners are in that same boat as well. So it's refreshing to hear that, hey, you weren't born running really, really fast right out of the womb. I'm curious, though, you said you thought of running as more, hey, this is what you do for weight loss. Now you're running 200 plus mile races. What ignited the love of running in you?
Yeah, so I got back from that mission that I served for my church. And when I got back, I barely missed the deadline to go to college for that semester. And so I didn't have a lot going on. And my sister was training for her first half marathon at the time. And she, you know, basically invited me to sign up and do it with her. And, you know, thought it sounded fun just to try it since I had nothing else to do. And so just in my training to get ready for that half marathon, like I started to enjoy it more. I don't know what the switch was, whether it was just like being in my 20s, going into college and like starting to get out of that high school mentality of like wanting to do the bare minimum. I'm not saying all high school students want to do that, but that's how I was. So yeah, I trained for that half marathon with her. I ended up running, it was like an hour and 29 minutes, which I was pretty stoked with. I think that was barely under like a 7 minute average. It's nothing to write home about, but for my first half marathon, I was pretty stoked about it. And so just from like seeing that I did okay at that half with minimal training made me think that, you know, if I actually put in some effort, maybe I could like be a good runner. And so I set a goal to walk onto my college track team. And so I started training like for shorter distances, like tried getting my mile time down and stuff like that. And through that process, I ended up getting in a skiing accident and I broke my back. I shattered my L1 vertebrae, had to get surgery. I had 2 rods, 9 screws put into my spine. And one of my first questions was after surgery was when I could start running again. And the doctor told me to wait roughly a year before trying running again. And long story short, like I set small incremental goals, like the day after surgery, like walking a mile a day, then try walking that mile a day faster. And then it transitioned to 2 miles a day. And within 3.5 weeks post-surgery, I was walking 6 miles a day. And I decided to just try running for half a mile and see what happens, which I got a lot of flack for at the time, but I mean, nothing felt worse compared to like my 6 mile walk. My half mile run felt equally as okay. Like I didn't feel amazing, but it didn't hurt worse. And so I just started running half a mile to 3/4 of a mile to a mile. And before I knew it, 6 weeks post-surgery, I was running a 10K. I signed up and ran a 10K. And then 3 or so months later, I took my brace off and I was running 5 to 13 miles a day just because I had nothing to do. I incompleted my college classes because that's what the doctor advised me to do, meaning I deferred everything for a full year. And then my job got rid of me because they thought I'd be in bed forever. And so like I literally had nothing else to do. So I just started running a lot every single day. And then that's kind of how I got introduced to ultra running and went all in after that.
So interesting. And as you were describing the brace, taking the brace off, I just had this view of Forrest Gump when his braces come off his legs. Like that's the thing that jumped in my mind. So you had kind of a Forrest Gump moment.
And a little bit.
Yeah. So interesting that in I got into trail running. You can't tell on this call, but I'm 6'4". I'm a Clydesdale. Bigger athlete, was a basketball player, and had friends that were doing OCR races. And so we started doing that, and they were not conducive to my body type, but we would train on the trails for the running portion. And I just found that to be more fun. And so that's kind of how I got into trail running and then ultimately ultras. So it's just interesting to see different people's paths, you know. It's a newer sport for most of us. And so I think there's not like a path into, you know, ultra running. It tends to go different directions. So very interesting to hear yours. I'm curious, you said early on, you now focus a little bit more on the athlete side and the coaching side, but you were balancing family and kids and running and life. How did you do that? I think that's something that we struggle with as everyday runners, is how to balance all that. I'm curious your perspective on how you did that.
I mean, the biggest thing was just committing to it. You know, I worked a typical like 8-to-5 type job in marketing. Fortunately, it was for the outdoor industry. And so it was actually for a running shoe company. And, you know, they were all runners and stuff. So if I was a little bit late to work because of a run, like, they were pretty understanding.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would get up between 4:30 and 5 every morning and run an hour and a half during the week. And then I would shower, go to work. Fortunately, I know this isn't possible for everybody in their job, but because I work at a running shoe company, there was an in-house gym. And so, you know, I would utilize my hour lunch break every day to use that gym and do strength training too. Sometimes if I didn't feel like getting up early, I would use that time to go run on the treadmill for an hour, or I'd just go run. Like, there was a nice path next to the building that I'd go run on sometimes too, which did take discipline because we were a close group. We were a small group because it was a new running shoe company at the time. It was Ultra Footwear.
Oh, yeah.
And I started working with them just like a few years after they became a company. But yeah, like, they would all, like, a lot of my coworkers would go bowling at lunch or go eat lunch together at a restaurant. And like, most of the time I'd either go run or lift weights. So there was definitely discipline to do that during lunch versus going out and having fun with my coworkers. And, you know, then shortly after me and my wife got married, we had our first child, and that was really hard. You know, everybody I worked with that were dads, like, just kept I almost think that, like, all the warnings that I got, like, motivated me to, like, try hard when we had our child, because I'd have all these, like, former runners, like, dad bod type workers that would just be like, hey, like, good luck. You know, I was a hardcore runner until I had my first child, and, like, you know, they'd grab their belly and say, now look at me, kind of a thing. And so I think that kind of, like, terrified me or something, or motivated me more. So, you know, even though I was up throughout the night, me and my wife, you know, obviously we did nurse our firstborn, but we did, you know, just because I wanted her to not have to be the one to get up every night. But essentially every other night she would pump into a bottle and we'd put that in the fridge. And so, like, you know, one night she would get up and might full on nurse our child. The next night was my responsibility to get the bottles and get up with the child. So yeah, it was definitely hard, like, getting up throughout the night, getting very little sleep, and then, you know, still getting up at 5 a.m. to get that run in. So it was just full on committing basically to my training schedule.
So it sounds like you were crewing your wife with your first child. Like, you were there for her with what she needed, what your baby needed.
Tried to be as much as I can.
Yeah, good for you. That's awesome. And I want to read something real quick, because I pulled this from your website. This is kind of your philosophy.
Okay.
Running and pushing your limits should be something that you love to do. It shouldn't be something that you feel forced to do. If you wake up and think, well, I better get in my run, then you probably need to find a different hobby. Comfort is a waste of potential, and you should love being uncomfortable. Obviously, we just heard your story. You were a little, you know, a little bit overweight as a kid, and you've transformed yourself into someone that has this kind of philosophy. I'm just curious, you know, what was it that got you from point A to point B? And tell us a little bit more about what you mean by comfort is a waste of potential.
It's a good question. I honestly think it was the experience I went through with breaking my back. I don't know what the switch was. Like, if I broke my back in high school, then I would have like full on grasped the opportunity to just lay in bed all day for a full year. And yeah. So I honestly don't know what switched in my brain. I'm sure, you know, serving my mission did that in some form, because, you know, there's a lot of commitment and dedication to leave your family for a while and just, you know, teach people about Jesus and God for like all day, every day for a couple years. And so I think that discipline and that like lifestyle definitely helped me appreciate like commitment a lot more. And then that whole comfort is a waste of potential. It's actually a phrase that we call him our mission president. He was an older gentleman. Him and his wife were in the mission, and they were essentially our parents while we were out there. And so every time we'd meet and like, you know, have Bible study, we would like, he would use that phrase, basically encouraging us to like get out. Cause it's scary to like go just talk to random people about God and Jesus, cause you have no idea how upset they're going to be or just how potentially rude they're going to be. And so he would keep saying comfort is a waste of potential to all of us, just to like, you know, encourage us to get out of that comfort zone and grow in the form of being like a disciple. And so I really just grasped onto that saying that comfort is a waste of potential, and just kind of became my philosophy with my running.
Yeah, and I was going to mention when I read that, I like, you know, that's a great philosophy for running, but it's also a great philosophy for life. I think anything worth having takes grit, determination, and comfort tends to be what we default to. Like you said, if you'd had the back injury as a kid, you probably would have said, man, more cartoons and laying in bed. That's our default. And I think this idea that we've got to really push ourselves to get out of our comfort zone almost has to be that daily mindset. You almost have to do that daily reset to say, hey, today I'm going to take advantage of the opportunities before me. I'm going to get that run, and I'm going to look forward to pushing myself. So I love that so much. And I'm so itching to get to Coca Dona, but I have one more question for you. And it kind of relates a little bit to Coca Dona, because you mentioned you started running, you started doing more trail running. There's one thing to do trail races. You mentioned the half marathon that you did. There's one thing, you know, to do a 50K, even 100K. It's a whole different thing to do a 200 miler. And I'm just curious, you started, you know, looked at your ultra sign up, you started doing 200s in about 2017. What was it that got you to that distance? Was it this idea that I want to continue to push myself and see where my limits are? I'm curious to know what got you into the 200s.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it, just to push myself more. When I started ultra running, I thought 100 milers were the glass ceiling. I don't know if that's the right term, but like that was like what everybody was trying to strive for. To an extent it was, because 200 milers were fairly new at that time. But yeah, so like, you know, I did my first 100 miler in 2014, I believe. And then I did two more in 2015. And then it was 2016, I was doing a couple others. And 2016 is when I learned about the 200 mile distance. And so just like learning like, oh, wow, there's another distance out there that's higher than 100 miles. It's, you know, it just turned into something that I became aware of and decided to train for it and get into it. And then through that process, realized that that's kind of my distance. That's something that I worked hard to get there, but I also like feel like it just kind of naturally became something that I kind of understood and grew. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Like, I just did it. And then I realized like, hey, like, this is kind of my distance. I did well at it, and I don't feel like I trained crazy like hard to be good at it. Like, it was just something that just kind of happened. And so I just decided to make that my niche and just started kind of to focus on it.
Yeah, it's interesting how we do different distances of races. Sometimes they just fit better for us for whatever reason. And it sounds like those longer distances, and I know you've done a lot of FKTs as well, it sounds like those longer distances really seem to be your jam, because you got pretty good success right away, as it looked like, at least on the Ultra sign up. pretty early success. Did that early success, was that part of the formula that said, hey, I really like this? Or was it just like, this is just something I enjoy being out there for that length of time, that distance?
Yeah, the early success was definitely helpful. So my first 200 was 2017, but that was also the year that I did the Triple Crown for the first time. And for those that don't know, it's the Triple Crown 200s is the Bigfoot 200, the Tahoe 200, and the Moab 240. And at the time, they were all 60 days apart. Today, she's had to like move one of them around, and so they're not as close together. But at the time, they were just like the first week of August, the first week of September, and the first week of October. So there was definitely like a, you got to figure out how to recover type aspect that year. But yeah, so I did the Triple Crown the year of my first 200, and I ended up winning the Triple Crown, meaning that my combined time between the three 200s were faster than the other. At the time, there was only like 12 or 15 people that did the Triple Crown, because that was the first year there was a Triple Crown. That was the first year of the Moab 240. But yeah, so like I won the Triple Crown, and that was my first time winning something. And so at the end of that Triple Crown, I knew that there was so much more I could, like, I knew I could do way better, because each 200, like, I had so many issues that really slowed me down. And as I'm just like, whenever I talk about that first Triple Crown, I'm always thinking, like, holy cow, how did I win that, because of how much walking I had to do just because of all the issues that I had. And so when I finished the Triple Crown that year, I was just like, okay, I'm going to take a year off from the Triple Crown, but I'm going to come back in 2019 and just like, hopefully, like, I'm going to work on everything that, like, all the issues that arose, I'm going to work on trying to fix those issues for a full year and a half, then come back and then like see how much time I can take off of my Triple Crown time. And then for those that know my story, that was the year of 2019. And that was the year that I ended up winning each individual 200 and set some form of course record on each of those 200s. And that experience was definitely like after that year, I was like, okay, the 200s are definitely my thing now. So I'm going to start focusing on that.
I have validation. I've won all of them and I've set course records. There's nothing like success to validate. And I'm sure too, the hard work that you put in paying off and just knowing how good you were at that distance was helpful as well. Well, you mentioned some issues with the 200s. And so I think this is a perfect time to transition to Cocodona 250. And I think a lot of us were glued to the live coverage. And it's really amazing how advanced now, relative even a couple of years ago, that the live coverage is. Aravipa does such a great job. I was at Bandera this year. They were, you know, doing live coverage at Bandera for the first time as well. And so a lot of us were glued to the coverage all week, starting early, early on Monday. And day one was not a great day for you. And I would love for you to talk to us a little bit about what happened on day one, because at one point, I think you were in 62nd place and Killian and Michael Versteeg were well out in front. Talk to us a little bit about day one of the Cocodona 250 2023.
Yeah, it was awful that first day. like I legit felt that everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Like I had gear malfunctions. I forgot essential gear at the start of the, or before the race even started. On my drive to the race, I realized I forgot my bladder. And there was a 4-liter capacity carrying requirement for that first day because of a very long, hot, exposed section. And so I had no choice but to run back and get that bladder, or else I wouldn't have been able to start. And so by the time I went back and got the bladder and came back to the start of the race, there was 4 minutes before the race actually started. Man. And so like, had to find a parking spot. It was awful. Had to find a parking spot, rushed over to get my tracker and check in, got into the starting corral with like a minute and a half to go. And then I had like some malfunctions with my watch, which was extremely stressful. And I essentially started my watch when the race started with that malfunction still happening. And so I was just like, well, hopefully like the watch light corrects itself along the way. And then the biggest thing was I forgot my electrolytes. I got to about mile three. I lose a lot of sodium per liter of sweat, so I need a lot of salt. I take roughly 600 to 700 milligrams an hour. And so it's a lot. And I got to the first aid station before that really, really long, hot climb and asked them if they had electrolytes. And they essentially gave me 500 milligrams. That's all that they were comfortable to give to me because, you know, obviously they had to have some for the other runners. And so I basically had enough salt to last me for what was going to be 7 or so hours. And that salt was like the amount of salt that I was given is something that I would do in an hour. Wow. And so I was very low on my sodium. I had a lot of cramping issues. And then if you get behind on sodium, that helps or that creates digestive issues. And so I had painful, like my stomach was in pain. I couldn't eat. I was cramping. And once I finally got to my crew and got my electrolytes, I started having to like figure out this balance of getting enough electrolytes to catch up, but not overdoing it. Because at that time, I was probably a few thousand milligrams behind on my sodium. And so like, if I just showed up and took 4,000 milligrams of sodium right there, like I'd just start puking, I'd start crapping, like your body can't absorb that much sodium at once.
Get rid of it as fast as it can. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had to like, and I was cramping too. So like, I just really had to like figure out this, like how much sodium can I take without upsetting my stomach, but like trying to take care of these cramping issues that I'm having. And so that was like a headache for me and kind of mentally messed with me. And then I started having pain in my spine, which is not common. Usually I get lower back pain from breaking my back, but never like directly on my spine. And I think I just got to the point where I was just like so miserable. I was looking for a reason to get medically pulled from the race. Oh, and wow. So like, I like showed up to an aid station. Oh, so before I tell this part, I blew past an aid station in the middle of the night. There was like a short quarter mile out and back to, it was called Camp Kippa. And I blew past that out and back. And at the aid station is at the top of a hill. Like you climb to it, there's the aid station, and then you drop for a few miles. And so I was running downhill for 2.5 miles. I went past this aid station and I called my wife and I was just like, hey, I feel like I should have seen the aid station by now. Can you look at the tracker and tell me where I'm at? And I, you know, I wait for a minute or something. And then I just kind of hear her groan in the background.
Oh, no.
It's not. Yeah. It's not. And so I was just like, what? And she just said, it looks like you're 2 to 2.5 miles past the aid station. And you have no choice but to go back because you have to check into the aid station. So I did an extra 5 miles and, you know, 2.5 of it was straight up a hill. So it probably took me a good hour and a half to do that 5 miles. And so missing the aid station, I get to the aid station. So I'm just mentally burnt out. Like, you know, I had a watch malfunction. I had a shoe malfunction. My spine was hurting. I messed up my electrolytes. I blew past the aid station. Like I was just so upset because at the start of this race, I had never been so confident in where I was at physically. I was just like, this is going to be like the best race of my life. And so to have all these issues, like just really like sent me into a dark place. And so anyway, so I made up this like story. At the time I believed it, but like in retrospect, I'm like, I was probably just trying to figure out a way to get medically pulled. But I was just like, I started feeling my spine. And like, as I'm feeling it right now, like I just have a bumpy bolt, like I have a bumpy spine. But like when I got to the aid station and was feeling it, I made up this crazy story that like, well, what if my screws are coming out or something? Because I've read that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because I've read that people who have hardware in their back, that can be a problem. Obviously, when I started running again after breaking my back, I wanted to like be aware of things that I need to look out for. And so I called a volunteer over. She felt my spine, felt her spine. And she was just like, oh, yeah, that's like, I don't have that in my back. And so she started feeling other people's backs and like no one else had that. And so, you know, that did make me a little bit more concerned. And so she ended up calling a medic who was about an hour and a half out. And,
oh man,
you know, at this time again, I was just done. So I was just like, okay, cool. I'm going to go take a nap and I'll wait for the medic, thinking that they were going to pull me. He gets there. He feels my back. He's like, yeah, I think it's just bruised and inflamed from your bladder because I typically don't wear a bladder. So he was like, if you can handle the pain, I think you're going to be fine. And that I didn't want to hear that.
That was not the answer you were looking for.
No. And so I asked him, I was like, well, if I decide to drop, like, are you going by the next aid station? Because that's where my crew is. And he said, yeah, I can give you a ride if you drop. And I asked him how much longer he would be at that aid station. And he said 10 to 15 minutes. And I said, okay, I'm probably going to drop, but I'll think about it. During that 10 to 15 minutes at that aid station was Jeff Garmeyer and Pete Kosselnick. I don't know. I'm sure. Have you heard of them?
I have not.
Okay. They're awesome. Like, Jeff Garmeyer has a couple long FKTs. This is his third year doing Cocodona. Pete Kosselnick, he's into those like 10-day races. He has the transcontinental record, or at least he used to. I don't know if he still does. So very, very well accomplished runners. And when they saw I was going to drop, they essentially were just like, hey, we feel like crap. We've been puking all day. We're just going to walk together to the next aid station and tell stories and have a good time. So like, just come with us. Like, don't drop here. And so those two like saved my race because you never know what would have happened, but like with how down I was, like I know the chances of me quitting were pretty high at that aid station. And so I went with them. We had a good time. I got to the next aid station where my crew was. It was like 3 or 4 a.m. At this point, I was a ways behind the leaders. I just came in and was like, hey guys, I'm just so upset. I'm frustrated. Like, I don't really care anymore. So I'm going to go take a nap in my rooftop tent. Don't wake me up. When I wake up, I wake up. And so I think that ended up being about a 3-hour nap at that aid station. And so as I'm telling this, like, obviously a lot of time's building up. Like, I did an extra hour and a half of running by missing the aid station. I chilled at that aid station for over 2 hours waiting for the medic, trying to decide what to do. And then I took like a 3-hour nap. So like the time is adding up quite a bit right now. I woke up from that nap. My crew told me that I was about 35 miles behind the leaders at that point. I've heard so many different things. I've heard 62nd place. I've heard 70th place. I've heard 75th place. So somewhere in that range is where I was. And it's definitely more than I've ever been. Like, I've never been that far behind before. And I'm pretty sure they said that the leaders left 9 to 10 hours earlier from that aid station. So 34 miles, 9 to 10 hours behind. I decide to go to the next aid station because it's 8 miles mostly downhill. And it's to Whiskey Row, which is a pretty cool place. You know, at a minimum, I would have liked to get there and just like hang out if I decided to quit. And so I was like, I'll do the next 8 miles, see how I feel. And something happened in those 8 miles where like my mentality like completely shifted. And I got to Whiskey Row and my crew, you know, I had Ben Light there. I had my wife there. I had a couple other people that I coached there, but Ben and my wife are at all of my races. So they can tell when I'm motivated and when I'm not motivated. And so like when I came running into Whiskey Row, they could tell that I was back. And so like, you know, they sat me down and like the game plan started. And so Ben, my wife was like taking care of my feet and stuff. And Ben was just like, okay, buddy, if you pick it up, like we're pretty sure that you can catch up and get into the top 10. And for whatever reason, I don't know what caused the mental shift. And I don't know, like I've never been this confident in a race before, but like I looked up at Ben and my wife and I said, the goal hasn't changed. I'm still going to go after first. I'm still going to go after the course record. And I could tell in their faces that they didn't think it was going to happen, which I'm totally fine with. Like, I'm not mad at them for feeling that way. It almost motivated me more because I definitely have that personality where if people think that it can't be done, I'm going to try to get out there and show them that it can be done. And so, you know, at that point on mile 80 forward, I had no doubt that I wasn't going to catch first and still get that course record. And that's kind of where things turned around for me.
Amazing. You mentioned this and it kind of goes back to the story you told about having kids and people telling you, you're going to get a dad body. It feels like there's something in you, Mike, that says, hey, if you tell me I can't do it, I'm going to prove to you that I can. And this idea that top 10, for most people, that's an amazing accomplishment. But for you, that wasn't your goal. Your goal was first place. I am curious, though. It would have been, as you mentioned, you walked with your friends to the next aid station where your crew was. I could see how that would have been a really easy place to drop, but you decided to go on to Whiskey Row. It seems like, was it just the idea of going to Whiskey Row, or is there something else that said, you know what, let me just see how I feel once I get there?
Well, I honestly think that 3-hour nap is what did it, because this race is making me like rewrite my whole strategy to 200s, because I believe this was like my 8th or so 200. I know it's over 10 in terms of like the FKTs I've gone after, like 200 plus mile distances. Like I've done at least 10 of them at this point. And all the other ones I've ran through the first night, ran through the second day, took like a 30 minute dirt nap on that second night, and then just like tried to rely on caffeine to get me to the finish. And the reason is because it's very rare for me to lead a 200. Usually like I purposely settle back and then catch first roughly around mile 150. And that's my strategy. But like, I've always been afraid to take a nap on that first night because I, in my head, falling 3 hours behind was too much. Like I always tried to settle in that hour and a half or so behind first place. And so 3 hours, I was just like, I can't take a 2 hour nap on this first night because I'm going to get 3 hours behind and that's going to be too much to make up. And so this is my first 200 where I've slept the first night and, you know, let alone for 3 to 4 hours, I've never slept over an hour at a 200 before. And so I think that sleep, I mean, Sarah Ostaszewski, she's the female winner of Coca Dona. And this was her first year too, where she tried sleeping more on the first night and the second night. And, you know, she fell behind, but she caught up when the wheels fell off the leaders who chose to push the boundaries of sleep. And so I honestly think like everything shifted for me just from that 3 to 4 hour nap that I took that first night.
So interesting. So your sleep strategy was push it through the first night, no sleep until the second night, only 30 minutes. You were forced to change that strategy, took the 3 hour nap, and now that's informed you. And to your point, I mean, 200 mile racing is still fairly new, and a lot of the strategies around that are fairly new. So you've kind of uncovered this insight accidentally that it sounds like you're going to apply into your next 200 mile race.
Yeah, I mean, because it's made me realize, I mean, obviously 100 mile races are going to be totally different, but I fell 9 to 10 hours behind first place. And so like putting that into perspective of my fear of getting 2 to 3 hours behind first place, like I remember the point in Coca Dona because I kept having my pacers check the tracker and tell me how close I was getting to the leader. And I remember the point where I like got within a 3 hour window of the leader finally. And like in my head, I was just like, oh yeah, this is awesome. Like 3 hours is not that far when you compare it to 9 to 10 hours. And I made up that 3 hours relatively fast. And so, yeah, this experience made me realize if you bank sleep early on that first night, like I don't think I'm going to do 3 to 4 hours in a 200. Yep. You know, I think 2, maybe 2.5 hours on the first night would suffice. Yeah, at that point, if I fall 3 or so hours behind the leader on that first night in a future 200, I'm at the point now where I don't believe that that's too far behind and you can make that up relatively easy.
Love it. Was there a point, you know, you mentioned, hey, I'm not just shooting for top 10. I'm shooting for number one. You may not have believed that at the time. I don't know if you did or not, but was there a point during the race in which you thought, yes, this actually is possible. I think I can get first place, which is my goal. Was it that 3 hour window or is there something else that triggered that?
No, I think it was that. Like at Whiskey Row, I believed it could happen. And I don't think there was ever a point after Whiskey Row where I didn't believe it could happen. It definitely, though, as I got closer, like, you know, as I started knocking more and more people off, as I got into the top 10, as I got into the top 5, like there were definitely milestones where it confirmed my belief and like that belief was stronger. But yeah, I never like doubted that it wasn't going to happen.
That's great. And I think another lesson here too is you never know what's going to happen at the front.
Yeah.
So for Killian, his strategy was redline it, push it as hard as he could. And that definitely cost him later in the race. Michael Versteeg, I think, had a medical issue as well. So you never know what's going to happen at the front, especially a race this long. A question that I have, and I saw a picture of you and Killian. I think it was at the point in which you passed him. I think as everyday runners, we're always curious because I've never passed a leader before and never will probably. What is that like? And is that a friendly thing? Does it depend on the person? What is that like when you're actually, you know, passing people on the way and particularly when you're passing the leader?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the, it doesn't depend on the person. You know, I've had my fair share of races where I've caught the leader, you know, Tahoe 200, I caught the leader at mile 175. And yeah, like I've always had to catch a leader and there was only one experience where it was kind of bad. I caught the leader. I passed him. And I passed them like half a mile before a big river crossing. And I got to that river crossing and like, it was deep. It was flowing. Like I was really nervous to cross it. And it was in the middle of the night. And then he got there and I was just like, man, where do you think we should cross? This looks rough. And he didn't say anything. And I just kind of kept looking around. And all of a sudden I looked up and I saw him on the other side and he was just going. I was just like, what the heck? And so I started looking around and there was a rope crossing a little bit up. And he found it and took it, and like he didn't let me know. I'd like to think I would let the person know, and I believe that a lot of other runners I know would let the person know. And so when that happened, like that just like infuriated me. So in that moment, like do you follow David Goggins?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so like that was like really the only moment where I was just like, I'm about to take this MF-er's soul. Like, so I crossed that water and I just blew past him. I didn't say a thing. I was just really mad. And so that was the only moment in my racing where passing the leader was not a pleasant experience. Like it was an angry experience, but like usually it's very cordial. You congratulate each other and encourage each other. Killian and I know each other. And so we stopped and chatted. I could tell he was struggling. He was showing symptoms of pulmonary edema. He was wheezing and it sounded like there was like liquid in his chest. And he was talking about how like he didn't think he could go up over Eldon with how hard it was for him to breathe and that he was thinking of quitting. And, you know, at that point, I passed him with just under a marathon to go. And so I was just like, buddy, get to this next aid station. I can only imagine how crappy you're feeling right now because you've been leading this whole race and now I'm passing you. Like, I know that that's not a good feeling, but, you know, where you're at right now is course record pace. You essentially have 60 hours still to get to the finish. So I know it's not what you want, but get to the next aid station, take a nap if you need to, like try to let your body reset itself and like get to the finish. You can easily get in the top 10 still, which he did. He ended up going to that aid station and taking a nap. But yeah, like we knew each other. So I gave him a little bit of advice. He congratulated me. We took a picture together and then parted ways.
And I think that's what one thing I love about trail racing, ultra running is it seems like there is that mutual respect. There's that encouragement. I remember when I did Bandera several years ago, I did the 50K and they had to move the course because of rain. And so the 100K folks had to do a loop and then they had to turn around and do the loop again. So I remember I was coming in to finish my 50K while these 100Kers were leaving. So we had to pass each other. And they're having to go out throughout, you know, the middle of the night and do another 50K. And they're like, hey, way to go. Great job. You know, I'm almost done. They're about to spend another 10, 12 hours out there. And they were just encouraging me. And that's one thing I love about the ultra running sport is it seems like your experience with that one bad experience is the outlier. The norm is to encourage and like you encourage Killian to keep going. Your two friends encourage you to go to that next aid station. And I think, too, what I love about trail running as well and ultra running is sometimes you're the hero. Sometimes you're the athlete that's out there performing. And other times you're the support. You're part of a crew or you're pacing a friend or whatever. And there's this kind of symbiotic relationship that happens. So I think that's just such a great thing. Well, Mike, congratulations on winning the Cocodona 250. I think you'd come in second the year before. Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. It's a little bit. I don't know if there's redemption or like, hey, this year is the year, but early on didn't look like it, but you persevered. And I think you've taught us a lot about just keep going and because you never know what can change. I'd like to finish this time and I want to be respectful of your time talking a little bit about your faith, because I know you're a Christ follower, as am I. And I'm just curious, you know, how your faith impacts your running, your community, how you treat, you know, other people. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of my running, I'm sure a lot of other followers of Christ, God, like whoever people believe in, like I'm sure they utilize their running as a way to like feel closer to that person, that deity that they believe in. And so I've definitely noticed my relationship grow stronger through my running just because of like all the times like you reach the darkest of dark moments and you know, as somebody who believes in Christ, like, you know, I believe that he's felt those dark moments through his atonement. And so like, it's very just comforting to know, like, you know, that first day at Cocodona, where I just felt like absolute garbage. I felt miserable. I was upset that I wasn't having the race that I thought I was going to have in that moment. you know, it was a little bit more comforting to believe that Christ felt those feelings through his atonement. And then, so yeah, I definitely feel like I've grown closer. I actually have a tattoo on my arm of a mountain range. And it's actually like supposed to represent the Triple Crown of 200s. It has three different peaks. Two of the peaks are the same. One peak's a little bit bigger to represent the Moab 240. But I'm sure you've seen paintings of this before, but I kind of replicated it on my tattoo. But I have two sets of footprints going up the mountain, and then one of them stops, and it's just one foot or one set of footprints. And that's just to represent my relationship with Christ, that, you know, I believe that, you know, my strength, my endurance, that it wouldn't be what it is without him. And that, like, when I reach those low moments, he's the one that ends up carrying me forward. So yeah, I definitely try my best to show my appreciation to the Savior and feel closer to him through my running.
Yeah, I love that. We talk on this show about, you know, we tend to want to overcomplicate things and point fingers, and I'm a fellow Christ follower. It's all about, Jesus told us two things, you know, love God and love others. You know, there's this idea of vertical love and horizontal love. And that's one thing I think about the trail running community. There's that support and that love and that appreciation, and what size or shape or color does not matter. Mm-hmm. That we just support and love each other. And so I love how that informs what you do too. And I know too, I think I've read something that you have a big heart also for orphans. You've done some things around running on behalf of that. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So there's a nonprofit that I'm affiliated with and try to raise awareness for that's called Rod's Heroes. And that's RODS. Rod stands for Racing for Orphans with Down Syndrome. They tend to utilize athletes to raise awareness for them. And anyway, people might not realize this, but internationally, there's an issue of orphans with Down syndrome who get abandoned, especially like in China. There's a big issue in China, but, you know, they have the child, they find out it has Down syndrome, and they'll legit abandon that child on a busy street corner. And so there's tons of orphans with Down syndrome throughout the world internationally. And there's tons of families who are willing to adopt these children, but they don't have the funds. For those who don't know, like, it costs anywhere from 30 to 40 grand to adopt these children. And so Rod's Heroes essentially raises awareness of these children and then tries to raise adoption grants for these children to help offset the expensive costs of adopting. And so their mission is to find families. Their mission is to find people who can donate to those families, to those children. And I'm just out there trying to also raise awareness of these children, of those families, and in hopes of finding people of wealth who can make sizable donations to the organization, as well as people who are open to adopting a child with Down syndrome.
Love it. Yeah, I've got a heart for orphans as well. Done some work at an orphanage in Mexico, and there's nothing more, I think, fulfilling than being able to help someone that can't help themselves. And so thank you so much for the work that you're doing with that organization. And I want to be respectful of your time. I could talk for hours with you, Mike. I've got so many other questions, but I want to be respectful of your time. And I'm just so honored that you joined us today. If someone wanted to learn more about you or get in touch with you or learn more about Rods, what's some ways that they can do that?
I'm the Low Carb Runner on Instagram. And my email is thelowcarbrunner@gmail.com. I have a website that's lowcarb-runner.com. Those are probably the three best places to reach out to me. And Rods is https://www.rods.org. You can go there or just Google Rods Heroes. But if you go to their website, they have lists of children that are eligible for adoption. They have donate buttons. They have resources for family who are interested in adopting. So yeah, it's a great organization to go check out.
Awesome. Well, definitely encourage the listeners to reach out, connect with Mike, and learn more about Rods if you're interested. Mike, thanks so much. Again, congratulations on your amazing race. We learned so much in your story about Cocodona 250. I think you did as well. So thanks so much for joining us, and I really appreciate you being on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
What a great guy, Mike. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with the Big Ass Runner Herd. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. So much to learn, even from the elites. For those of us who aren't elite, there's just lessons to be learned around trail running and ultra running. So appreciate Mike for spending some time with us. Well, thanks to you for joining the show, and thanks to our amazing partners at Path Projects. We talked about the Cocodona 250. I saw Path gear all over the place in the live coverage. They are the best trail running gear apparel out there. Absolutely love their stuff. Go to pathprojects.com. Thanks to our audio engineer that makes this sound so good, Steve Cinnamon Bear Saunders. And with that, get out there, hit those trails, and keep running your asses off.